And as usual, we're all gathered here today to listen to another exposition of the Lord Buddha's teachings, the Lord Buddha's Dhamma. Before we commence, let us all take a moment to remind ourselves of how extremely fortunate we are. In its every sense, to be in receipt of his teaching, the only path that exists to deliverance, the only path to our liberation, the only path to freedom. We have, in this long journey in samsara, gone after various paths, taken various pursuits. However, only now have we come across the only path, the unitary path, the single path to our freedom. This is why it is important that we remind ourselves of our good fortune, to consider ourselves the Buddha's disciples, his students, followers of his teaching. So before we commence then, let us take a moment to pay homage to the perfect one, to the fully enlightened one, the most magnificent one, the most graceful one, the most merciful one, the most sublime one, the unvanquished one, the undefeated one, the omniscient one, the supreme Gautama Buddha. Let us do this by reciting the stanzas which were once offered, which were once uttered by Upali the householder when questioned, "Whose student are you? Whose follower are you? Whose disciple are you?" Let us answer that very question today in our own words. So let us all be upstanding to recite these stanzas and then continue with the rest of today's proceedings. Dhirasya vigata mohasya abhinna khilasya vijita vijayasya anighasya susamachittasya buddhasilasya sadhupanyasya vissantarasya vimalasya bhagavato tasya savako hamasmi akatankatissa tusitasya vantalokamisasya muditasya katasamanasya manujasya antimasarirasya narasya anopamasya virajasya bhagavato tasya savako hamasmi asansayasya kulasya venaikasya sarati varasya anuttarasya ruchiradhammasya nikhankasya abhasakarasya manachidasya virasya bhagavato tasya savako hamasmi nisabhasya appameyasya gambhirasya monapatasya khemankarasya vedasya dhammattasya sanguttatasya sangatigasya muttasya bhagavato tasya savako hamasmi nagasya pantasenasya khina sanyojanasya muttasya patimantakasya dhonasya pannadhajasya vitaragasya dantasya nippapanchasya bhagavato tasya savako hamasmi namo tasya bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasya namo tasya bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasya namo tasya bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasya
Now to seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem and observe the precepts, please repeat all together and after me.
Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Saranagamanam sampunnam. Panatipata vedamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinnadana vedamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Kamesu micchachara vedamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Musavada vedamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Suramereya majjapamadatthana vedamani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Tisaranena saddhim panchasilam dhammam sadukam surakhitam katma apamadena sampadeta.
Okay, give me now all the secret. Excuse me. Also, before we commence the sermon, let us all take a moment to invite all the countless celestial beings, the divine beings, out there within earshot of this sermon, with any capacity to join us within these 10,000 world systems. Let us invite them to join us and witness this meritorious deed that is about to unfold. Let us remind ourselves that among them will be those beings who will have been mothers and fathers to us, our siblings, our teachers, our friends. Those who came to our help in our most difficult times, those who came to our rescue and lent us a helping hand when we needed it most. These are beings who never left us destitute. They were always there for us, standing by our side. It is perhaps they that is the reason we have today been spared from the four hells. Perhaps it is they who took our turn in guarding us, protecting us, in sheltering us. Perhaps they committed unmeritorious deeds on our behalf. And today, they are where they are, and we are where we are. But as we reflect on this, we must be reminded of our duty to help them, as they once did for us. So with generosity, with kindness, with compassion, and a sense of duty and obligation, with boundless compassion emanating from the bottom of your hearts, as I now invite the devas, the brahmas, the spirits, the demons, and those who have predeceased us, not just in this birth, but also in previous births. Let us take a moment to invite them to join us and witness this meritorious deed, to rejoice in these merits and acquire merits, to help them redeem themselves from the woeful states that they may be in,
and be born in the blissful plane. And for all sentient beings in the blissful plane, may they receive this opportunity to listen to the teaching of the great teacher, understand and comprehend it, and free themselves once and for all from the four great hells and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So as I now make this invitation, please extend this invitation out to all of them to join us, to witness this meritorious deed, to listen to the Dhamma, and to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata saddhammam munirajas sunantu saggamokkhadam dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta.
Okay. Also, before we begin, it is important for us to remind ourselves and understand the fact that although today we find ourselves in good companionship, among good friends, among noble friends, we do not always have such merits. In this long journey in samsara, we have virtually always found ourselves in the association of ignoble, immoral people. These associations defiled our minds with desire, aversion and delusion, and having been blinded in ignorance and attachment, we overstepped the mark. On countless occasions we may have offended, insulted, reviled and desecrated the noble ones. Unfortunately, the consequences of such actions today come to haunt us as we make efforts to listen to the Dhamma, to free ourselves, to become like the ones we once insulted. The results of our actions today hinder us from making progress. They steal our alertness. They steal our attention, our ability to comprehend. They distract us and throw us out of the path. Hence it becomes an incredibly difficult task to make progress in the Dhamma. This is why before we begin the sermon, it is important that we take a moment to seek forgiveness. Genuinely, honestly. So before we begin then, let us all take a moment to humbly accept and acknowledge that we have wronged. Had we not done so, we would not have come this far. So all of us, we have wronged, we have reviled and desecrated and insulted and offended the noble ones. Any thoughts, words or actions then of reviled desecration, slander, insult or offense that we might have directed towards the noble triple gem, the Samma Sambuddhas, Pacheka Buddhas and Arahata Buddhas, Anagami, Sakrudagami, Sotapannas, be they on the path or having attained the fruits, as well as the Buddhas ministry, the Sambuddha Sasane, let us take a moment to seek their forgiveness. And as you take this moment to reflect on this, I urge you to make a solemn promise to yourself to never find yourself conducting your thoughts, words or actions in this manner ever again.
And finally, let us all make a firm resolve, may through the course of this sermon, may I be able to understand the Four Noble Truths. May I free myself from the four great hells once and for all, and be able to embark on the noble path to liberation. May I be able to achieve the first noble state of Sotapanna. For any among you who may have already achieved that noble state, may through the course of this sermon, you be able to fulfill the subsequent stages and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. With that resolve in mind, I invite you to prepare yourself to listen to this sermon. Okay. It is very satisfying to see that most of you, I'd like to think it's all of you, but as I don't have evidence, categorical evidence, I struggle to say all of you, but I can see from most of you, because I have evidence, that you have in the past, and you continue to practically apply yourself in the Dhamma. Something that Guru Swami Mahansa always reminds us and always encourages us to do, both in our sermons and in our conversations with our devotees. Is to, both on a personal level as well as in the sermons, remind everyone that Nibbana is a very extremely pragmatic and practical undertaking. The theory and the knowledge of the theory in itself hardly does anything. The Buddha did, of course, expound volumes of knowledge, and he expounded truths about the worlds, world systems, about the universe. He expounded deep and profound truths about the world, both in a conventional and in an absolute sense. Things that perhaps in a lifetime we will never comprehend, because our wisdom does not extend that far. Some of these suttas were uttered to his chief disciple, the most venerable Sariputta Thera, who was only second to the Buddha in his wisdom. It is virtually impossible for someone to comprehend everything that the great Venerable Thera Sariputta could. So just because the Buddha has preached something that he discovered, a portion of the Dhamma, part of his infinite knowledge, does not mean it is something that we are all going to be able to comprehend in this lifetime. First and foremost, we must understand that. We must be willing to accept that. We must be ready and willing to accept that we are not the Venerable Sariputta Thera. Causes will bring results, but where there are no causes, a result is impossible. It is not just improbable, it is impossible. In the era of this Buddha, you and I will never be able to develop our supernatural powers to match the likes of the Buddha's left-hand disciple, the most venerable, great Moggallana Thera. That is an impossibility. The chances of that happening are 0%. That is the probability. It is an impossibility. So, we must understand that. It is not ourselves undermining ourselves. It is accepting the principle of cause and effect. It is accepting the variations in the paramitas. The lights of the great elders Sariputta Thera and the great Moggallana Thera, they had a very different duty to us. Their advent was to propagate the Dhamma, the Sambuddha Shasana, to ensure that it lasts for 5,000 years. If the two of them had not been around, then the Buddha's dispensation would probably not last all that long. We must understand this and accept that our duty is first and foremost to ourselves. We must acknowledge that we are never going to be able to go through, read, understand and comprehend every sutta there is in the Tripitaka. Are you willing to accept that? Are you willing to accept that? Because if not, then you are trying to do the impossible. And your energies are better invested elsewhere. The Buddha gave us a raft to cross the river of samsara, not something to carry on our backs and burden ourselves. This is why Guru Swami Mahansa always reminds us and always urges us to remind our listeners, our devotees, to understand the purpose of the Dhamma and make the approach to Dhamma extremely and as much as possible a practical one. He appreciates your efforts, all of the little practical things that you do having listened to the sermons and taking on the advice. And when you write back to us your results, as well as the confirmation that you have started to do some of the practical things that we have asked, whenever I get a moment, I share that with him. These are things that earn you a lot of praise. Of course, today you don't get to hear from him in his own voice. But believe you me, whenever he is informed that your practice in the Dhamma is practical and that is your approach, he appreciates that a lot. I have shared with him some of the things that you have promised yourself to do in the new year. I have shared your goals with him. I have shared with him the way you document them and you structure yourself and you track yourself as you make progress on this path. I have informed him that quite a few of you engaged in the activities, have engaged and continue to engage in the activities that we suggest to you, as an example, carrying a voice recorder in your pocket, carrying it around with you for a day, for half a day at least, some of you for a couple of days, a week long. These are the things that he really appreciates. Because in his own words, he says, a lot of people, when asked to do such practical things, will think, why should someone like me bother with something like that? I am much more advanced in the Dhamma. I don't need this little pesky little activities. Give me big, give me deep, give me profound. Give me the most incomprehensible sutta that you can find in the Tripitaka, and I'll work my way through that. In other words, give me a bone that I can keep chewing on. He says, people who are like that will always keep chewing on that bone in this birth and also in future births. In his words, he says, but those people, however few they may be, who actually do the practical things that we ask them to do, worshipping the parents, caring for others, caring for oneself, for others, sharing what you have with others, making a resolve to donate or gift your most favorite sari to somebody else, making a promise to yourself to go and visit your teachers, to worship them, making a promise to worship your parents every day, to start to offer the Buddha Puja at home. The practical stuff. Writing down the spiritual goals, tracking them, trying and smartening them up, and tracking their progress. Approaching those who have either once wronged them or who they have once wronged, and making amends, saying sorry, picking up the phone and apologizing for that one word that came out at the wrong time in the wrong place with the wrong person. Reaching out to your husband, reaching out to your wife and asking them, what do you see are my faults? What one thing would you like me to change about myself that would make your life that much more beautiful, that much more happy? These are practical things, very practical things. In his own words, he says, those who continue to do these things will most certainly achieve results. He swears by that. He asks me, how else do you think I have come this far? How do you think I have come this far? How do you think I have changed so much? He says, you know where we started. He says, you know where we are today. And he asks me, how have we come this far? He asks me, do you see me just sitting to one side all day long, all night long, reading the Tripitaka and just flicking through those pages, trying to study the suttas and grappling my brains, trying to figure out what was uttered to the Venerable Sariputta there? Or do you see me among yourselves, helping out whenever I can, doing what I can to help and save other people from their miseries, lending a helping hand, lending a ear, or lending an ear to those who need it? Do you not see that my approach to Nibbana is a very practical one? A very down-to-earth one. A very ground on feet, or rather, a very feet on firmly on ground approach. And it is true what he says. Associating him as close as I am able to, I witness the changes that he goes through. And I can vouch for the fact that he's a very practical man. His approach to the Dhamma is a very practical one. It is most practical. He's always among us when we need him. He reminds me of Superman. When you need him, he's there. Don't know where he came from. I don't know where he comes from. Don't know when he leaves. But when you need him, he's there. Like, he just knows when we need him. And he's there. I've showed him some of the pictures that you sent through, with the words, what are you waiting for? On your folders, on your computer monitors, on your rice cooker, on your kettle, on your fridge, on your fan. And I have shared this with him, and he was very impressed. I know you don't do them to impress him. The reason I'm sharing this with you is if you have, as I have, accepted him as your teacher to help you and guide you on this path, then I think it is only right that we do as he has done. We do as he continues to do. As his ways, we have seen, have brought him results and a happiness that he didn't used to have. So if we'd like to be like him, then the only way to do that, the only way to get there, is to do like him. To be like him, do like him. And that is why you'll know whenever we receive questions from you, either via email, to be responded in the same channel, or some of which we raise in the sermons, I always have a natural inclination towards the practical questions, more so than the theoretical questions. Because the theory, that will come in time. And when you are ready, they will be uttered in the sermons. You know, sometimes you just have to surrender yourself to the laws and the principles that operate in this world. Ultimately, that is what we have to do. But until that happens, that is something we must try and do, at least. Ultimately, when you realize that all I am is nature, the principles of nature, the laws of nature govern me entirely, one day you will realize this entirely, and then your task is done. You know that we call this vipaka. Nature is another word for it. An arahant is someone who has given in to nature. He and nature are one. So until then, we need to make an effort. And we need to make an effort through our practical approach. So bear in mind, this is what your teachers appreciate. This is what your teachers encourage. And if you were here, if you had continued to come to the monastery, then you would have heard this in Guru Swami Mahansa's own words, his appreciation of your efforts. But for now, I will share that with you on his behalf. Make your approach to the Dhamma the most practical one. Nibbana is very practical. Nibbana is not in books. Nibbana is what happens to the mind. Nibbana is the putting out of the fire that is burning in the mind. To receive, you must give. What you give, you shall receive. So if you want to receive something, that is what you must give. So you see, if Nibbana, I love the Sinhala word for this, Nivana, which is to put out, to extinguish. And in the Sinhala language, we use this word often, to talk about putting out a fire. This is why I feel that this word signifies what Nibbana is perfectly. Because we use that word to express the meaning of putting out a fire. The mind is on fire. the fires of desire, aversion and delusion. And if you take into concern the laws and principles that govern nature, what you give is what you get. So if you ignite fires, then fires will ignite. If you put out fires, then fires will be put out. If you give fire, you receive fire. If you give water, you receive water. If you give heat, you receive heat. If you give cool, you receive cool. So if you want to cool yourself, cool others. That is why it is so important in the practice of Nibbana to make it very practical. You see, you can't cool anything by reading the Tripitaka. Because to receive, you must give. When you read the Tripitaka, what are you giving? This is not say don't read the Tripitaka. Because it is in the book. It is said what it is you must do, as it contains the Buddha's words. We must, of course, associate the three canons, and we must use it for reference, like a dictionary. When you want to have a conversation with someone, you don't pick up a dictionary and read it word for word, do you? That is not a conversation. What you do is, when you want to have a conversation with someone, and you struggle to express yourself in the best way, possible way, or you find, you come across a meaning that you know in one language, but you struggle to express that in another language, then you use the dictionary only as reference. Once you have gotten over that hurdle, then you close the dictionary and you put it back on the shelf. You don't carry the dictionary on your head. You use it for reference. Because the dictionary does not contain your conversation, does it? It contains words that you may need in your conversation. It contains words and their definitions, which may come useful in your conversations, but the dictionary does not teach you how to have a conversation. Therefore, a dictionary is not a practical guide to conversation. You'd be foolish to be using a dictionary in that context. But rather, a dictionary is a reference book, much as the Tripitaka is. The Tripitaka is a reference book. You go to it for information, for knowledge, to check something, to check the Buddha's take on things. You use it like a teacher, except one that cannot actively guide you, but a passive teacher. So the teachers come in two flavors, don't they? There are active teachers and there are passive teachers. The difference? An active teacher will observe you actively and give you feedback actively without you having to ask for it. Then there are passive teachers. If you have a problem, the teacher doesn't come to you. You have to go to the teacher and ask them for guidance. And the question you ask, you get that answer. Sometimes you may not be asking the right question. A passive teacher cannot set you right. Whereas an active teacher, if you ask the wrong question, they will tell you, "You have asked me the wrong question." Please correct your question and ask again. The Buddha was an active teacher. His Dhamma is a passive teacher. The Dhamma is now in the form of the Tripitaka, which is a passive teacher, and the Mahasangha, that's an active teacher. So you are not at a loss. Back when the Buddha was around, you had an active teacher and you had a passive teacher. Today, we don't have the Buddha. But because of his infinite compassion, he established the community of the Sangha to act as an active teacher. And his Dhamma, thanks to the council of the Sanghas, of the Sangha, the first council, the second council, the third council, and so on, today we have his teaching in the Tripitaka, written form, which is the passive teacher. So you must be very careful when you associate both, but more the passive teacher than the active teacher. Assuming the teachers are always right, so this is an assumption. The teacher is always right when we had our first active teacher, always right. But assuming the Sangha is always right, that is only an assumption we can make. No one is perfect. So no individual is perfect is what I'm trying to say. The Tripitaka is always perfect. Again, assuming that it contains the Buddha's teachings word for word. It is possible that over the period of time, various texts got distorted, perhaps. Maybe some of the suttas, when they were copied across from palmyra leaves to books, perhaps there were errors in transcripting or transcribing. Perhaps these things can always happen. But assuming that there are no such errors, the Tripitaka will always be right. But unfortunately, it's a passive teacher. Whatever question you ask, it will give that answer. The Tripitaka is not an active teacher to tell you you're asking the wrong question. That is why you must be careful when you dabble with the Dhamma. That is why it is always important to have a teacher, someone from the Mahasangha, an active teacher to guide you. So, again, coming back to the point I was trying to make there, make your practice a practical one. And as you have accepted Guru Hamdran Mahanse to be your active teacher, pay attention to his advice. Listen to what he has to say. Listen to what he says about the way he has practiced and got as far as he has. If the words that he preaches resound with you and you feel that is the kind of person I want to be like, that is the kind of cool that I'd like to experience, that I'd like to enjoy, then thankfully we have the principle of cause and effect to our rescue. Because there are no effects in this world which are not the result of causes. So whatever results he enjoys today, they are most definitely the results of causes, and those causes he shares with us. And those causes for him are very practical ones. So, as I said, I shared with him your pictures, your goals, your ambitions, and the really practical things you want to develop in this new year. Some of the things you want to cut back on, and some of the things you want to entirely put a stop to. Your resolve, your determination, these are things that has attracted his blessings upon you. So, you're in good hands. Just continue doing what you're doing. And those questions that you put forward, continue to keep them to a practical. Continue to keep them practical. As much as you can. There may be from time to time you need to clarify a point in the Dhamma. I'm not saying you mustn't do that. Let me in fact share with you a bit of advice I gave a group of our monks recently. They're preparing for their higher ordination, which is around the corner now. I told them, Venerable monks, whenever you study the Dhamma, whenever you listen to a sermon, and perhaps at the end of the sermon or in your study of the Dhamma, you come across points in the Dhamma, particular points in the Dhamma or aspects of the Dhamma which you struggle to understand. As an example, maybe you listen to one of Guru Swami Nuance's sermons, and in that sermon he says something and you struggle to understand that. You struggle to make sense of that, and you struggle to apply that into life. But oftentimes they do come to me and other teachers that we have at the monastery, our senior monks, to get such points clarified. The advice I gave them was, when you come to me with those questions and you want clarification, please ask yourself, what is the purpose of doing that? Are you coming to me with a point that you want to clarify for the sake of clarity? In other words, Dhamma for the sake of Dhamma. Then, frankly, you haven't gained anything from me. You haven't gained much from that sermon. You just know something that you didn't before. You just know it. Just like if you were to pick up the dictionary and read a random word. Look the word up and you look up its definition, right? Now you know something that you didn't before. Excellent. Good. I said, don't make your questions, don't come running to me with your questions if they are for the sake of clarifying the point of Dhamma. But rather, come to me and tell me, Swaminahansa, I would like to be a kinder person than I am today. I would like to be more generous than I am today. I would like to be someone who can pacify wounded hearts, burning souls. I would like to be someone who can wipe the tears off someone's face and bring them a happiness that they don't have. I would like to help someone extinguish the fires of desire and aversion and delusion. I feel that t- today's sermon is going to help me with that. But there is this aspect of the Dhamma which is unclear to me. My ambition, my goal, is not necessarily to learn the point of the Dhamma, but rather to change myself, to be a better person than I am today. Please help me. Now that is not Dhamma for the sake of Dhamma. Why? Because then again, they are taking a very practical approach. The Dhamma was preached to men and women to change themselves. Remember, the Dhamma was not preached to arahants, who did not need to change. The Dhamma was preached to men and women, and devas and brahmas, who needed to change. In the Buddha's eyes, they needed to change. In fact, you recall on one occasion when the great elder Sariputta was delivering a sermon to another monk, he did not realize that the monk who he was preaching to had attained enlightenment. He had become awakened. And not realizing this, he continued to deliver his sermon. When the Buddha approached, he realized what was going on. And the student monk had already completed his task. And so he said, "Sariputta, you can stop now. You need not go on any longer. You can stop now. The sermon can now conclude." And the Venerable Sariputta did not utter another word. So you see, the Buddha could have encouraged the Venerable Sariputta to continue, couldn't he? He said, "Oh, not good sermon, Sariputta. That's a really good one. Carry on." And he could have asked the other monk, who had now by this point become an arahant, to continue to learn the Dhamma, to memorize it, to analyze it. But what did the Buddha say? "Sariputta, you can stop now." He actually said, "Stop now." That was an order. "You can stop now." Does that not give us evidence that the Buddha himself believed that his Dhamma was simply a raft to cross the river of samsara? Once you cross the raft, once you cross the river, there is no longer any use for the raft. Now, you get off the raft and let someone else use it. You don't carry it on your back. You don't call it yours. You don't tie it around your waist and drag it behind you. That's it. You have used the raft and you have no longer any use for the raft. The Dhamma is like that. Remember, and please bear it in mind, in the Buddha's own words, he said, "Sariputta, you may stop now." You see? Is that not evidence that his Dhamma was for one purpose and for one purpose alone? To heal the wounded hearts. To put out fires. It's like water. When you see a fire, you see firemen. They'll come running with their fire engines. And you'll see them chucking water at the fire. If the fire stops, what do you see them doing? Imagine they get to the place of the incident with a full tank of water. One quarter of the tank is all they need to put out the fire. What do they do after that?
well, we've still got 3/4 of water left of the tank. We might as well just splash this water also. Do they want to empty their tanks? No, because now you have a flood. First you had a fire, now you have a flood. One mess replaced by another. These are all good similes, folks, for you to remember and really bear in mind on your practice in the Dhamma. I'm not saying that any of you have misunderstood the purpose of the Dhamma, but this is important for us to contemplate and reflect on from time to time. This is not an admonition. This is just friendly advice. When someone needs an admonition, I'll tell them so. This is not an admonition. This is just friendly advice. I must say that the tone of your questions have changed dramatically over the last several months and years. It may be to begin, it used to be that back in the day, donkey's years, a lot of questions that came through from some of you were very theoretical. That was the Dhamma for the sake of it. But now I must say that when I see questions that come from you, hardly do I come across one that is all theoretical. As a matter of fact, it is delightful to see that pretty much all of your questions are most practical ones. And the struggles that you have when you practically apply the Dhamma, the points you fail, the points you need an extra helping hand, you need an extra bit of support. What I'm trying to say is, this is what your teacher, Guru Swami Mahansaya, appreciates. I'm not referring to the great teacher, the Buddha, the teacher that you have chosen to help you represent in the Mahasangha. He appreciates this, just as we all do. So continue with that. Continue to make your practice in the path a practical one. And one day you shall bloom like a blue lotus. Results are for those who sow. Not results are for those who know how to sow. What you reap is what you know how to sow. Right? Did I get that right? What you reap is what you know how to sow. Yeah? Of course, you know that is not correct. What you reap is what you sow. Actions will get you results. I think you have become an exemplary audience in that aspect. I must say, particularly our English sermon listeners. On the one hand, I think in terms of number, as you are, and fair and rightly so, smaller for now, for the time being, one day this is going to be so vast that 2/3 of the global population will listen to these sermons and find their peace, not for any other reason. I don't want a fan base. Thank you very much. It is for the very reason of finding their own salvation. So one day 2/3 of the global population, which will be no match to the number of people who will listen, understand and comprehend Sinhala. Perhaps 20 million is all who understand and comprehend Sinhala language and therefore sermons in that language. But sermons in English, as English is the global and international language, it is a key that opens these sermons to
to a vast majority of the global population. That is why I really do enjoy doing these English sermons, because I know that the number of hearts that I can heal through an English sermon is far greater than the number of hearts I can heal through a Sinhala sermon. True, I do struggle sometimes with the words in expressing the concepts using a manufactured language to express something natural. That is a struggle. Nibbana was never presented in English. It was in fact presented in Shuddha Magadhi. The closest relation to that we have today is either Pali or Sinhala. English is a long way from that. A very long way from that. So, it is a struggle there, but nevertheless, in terms of reach and breadth, these sermons have huge potential. This is not me patting my own back. I think you'll understand that. This is me encouraging you and inviting you to get involved as best you can in spreading these sermons, taking the words of the Buddha as far out as you possibly can. Get it to reach every nook and corner around this globe, because there are wounded hearts, burning souls that need to be helped. And a lot of you are involved in that task. I just want to show you that there are huge, tremendous merits to be earned in your engagement with these sermons. Because although today we may be few, there's going to be a day in future. And I feel it is in the near future. It is a gut instinct I have. In the near future, when the swing is going to tip, and this is going to get over its inertia, and it's going to go massive, and then, if we are still in samsara, you and I, can you imagine the amount of merits we will earn from everyone that these sermons will touch? To the men and women all over the world, the eastern and the western hemisphere, in the northern and the southern hemispheres, from the Americas to the Asia to the Atlantic to Africa to Europe. There's huge potential here. You know how much you have changed. You know how much your practical application has brought you results. I personally feel that there are many, countless, millions, if not billions, of people out there who has an instinct an instinct that tells them that there is something in the Buddha's teaching. Which may contain the answer to their life's problem. Of the 8 billion global population, I'd say there's at least a billion people out there . Remember, they have all come in samsara, a long journey. It is difficult to imagine that they have never heard the word Buddha in this long journey in samsara. They may not have come across one. They may not have gotten to listen to his teaching. But they have probably heard his name. If you ask people, just generally, what is their take on Buddhism, even a non-Buddhist, they will normally respond quite favorably. I am personally yet to come across someone who believes that the true Buddhist teaching, or who finds fault in the true Buddhist teaching. Not because they understand Nibbana, but they believe that it is a very peaceful one. One that teaches people to live harmoniously. One that encourages social well-being and harmony. So I'm yet to come across anyone who is able to, or who wants to, let alone able to, who wants to pick holes in the true Buddhist teaching. Perhaps there are those today who call themselves extreme Buddhists. When in the Buddha's words he said, avoid both extremes, there are some who call themselves extreme Buddhists. And it is possible that the actions of such people may have a not so positive influence on people's perspective or perception of Buddhist philosophy. Or at least Buddhism as a religion. But I think when you separate the religion and the philosophy part, when you separate those two parts, I think universally people believe that Buddhist philosophy may contain answers to their problems. The remaining 7 billion, let's assume, do not know of the Buddha. Do not know of Buddhism, either as a religion or a philosophy. I know my numbers are way off, because it is not the case. Almost everyone on this planet, adults, will have heard of Buddhism, at least heard of it. But I'm making a very small I'm simplifying the scenario here and trying to show you the potential that we have here. You are all part of this. All our listeners, as well as those who are involved in the transcription, you're all part of this. It is not only the monks who preach. But those who make these sermons available to our online audiences, transcribe them in written form, transliterate them, time log them, help with the housekeeping, all that. Make donations, including the technology that we make use of. What I'm trying to show you here is you are tapping into something that is going to be enormous, become enormous in the near future. All of you who are involved with this are assembling a merit-generating machine. So keep working at it. One day you will reap the results, because you are sowing, so you must reap. From what I know about people who claim to be Buddhists or who are exploring Buddhism, either theoretically or as a religion for them to follow or as a practice for their spiritual progress, a lot of them don't understand what true Buddhist philosophy is. A lot of them don't understand that this is a very practical thing. A lot of them think that it is all about sitting cross-legged and meditating for hours, if not days, weeks and months at a stretch. But understand that what you give is what you receive. That is why this has to be practical. To receive, you must give. If you give fire, you receive fire. And where Nibbana is the putting out of fire, and fire can be put out by that which is the opposite of fire, then that is what you need to give. So go looking for the wounded hearts, the burning souls, and help them. Help cool them. Help pacify them. Help extinguish those flames. And make your study of the Dhamma practical in the sense that you practice the Dhamma to become a better person so that you can better help those who need your help. Think of medical college, for instance. A medical student spends a minimum of 5 years in med school. In each of these 5 years, he learns more than he has learnt in the previous year. He engages in study, both theoretical and practical. He gains knowledge. He understands the workings of the human body, physical and mental, or psychological. Reason is we want to make a doctor out of him, a medical doctor. We want to make a healing machine out of him. We want to transform this living, eating, breathing thing into a healing machine. A machine that can be used to heal. So that is why a medical student goes to medical college. Both he and his teachers understand that the output of this process, the outcome to be expected out of this process, is a healing machine. That is the task at hand. If at any point they realize that he does not want to be a practicing doctor at the end of this, chances are that both the student and the teachers will come to an agreement that it is no longer necessary for you to continue at medical school. What you can do now is perhaps go and read some books. If you wanted to learn about medicine but not practice it. In fact, in some countries, it is essential that you practice after you have become a qualified doctor. It is mandatory. Therefore, the expectation is that what we are making out of this process by teaching this knowledge, by transferring this knowledge, what we are doing is we are making, we are creating, we are nurturing and we are grooming a healing machine. A machine that can heal others. And the same principles apply in the Dhamma. When you come to this school, come with that intention. When you have questions in the Dhamma and you go and ask your teacher, please teacher, can you explain this to me? I'm struggling to understand this concept. Ask it with that intention. I want to become a healing machine. To become a healing machine, I think I need to understand this bit. Now, you see, if your teacher says, well, actually, to become a healing machine, you don't need to understand that bit. You must be able to say, thank you, sir. If you say so. But if your intention is not to become a healing machine and only to satisfy your hunger for knowledge, then you will not be able to accept that as an answer from your teacher. Yes or no? If you have some riddle in the Dhamma that you're trying to get your head round, you have found this new sutta in the Tripitaka. It's not a new sutta, but you have found a sutta that not many people know about, not many people speak of. I mean, usually that is what people like to do, right? They want to find something that not many people know, not many people talk about, and present it as their own finding to earn some credit. The very reason the sutta is in that book is so that you become, you feel you don't need credit. But they use it for exactly the opposite reason. And then they go looking for a teacher and to try and understand that sutta. So then, if the teacher says, that sutta was actually delivered by the Buddha to the great Moggallana Thera. And it was targeted towards him for his becoming the second disciple of the Buddha and for nothing else. Then The person who's asking this question must be able to at that point drop the question. Don't you think so? But if he's adamant, well, no, I think you must explain this to me because I want to understand it. Then you must ask the question, is that because you also want to become like the great Mahamoggallana Thera? If there's another sutta in there which was uttered by the Buddha to the great Sariputta Thera to help him become chief among the wise bhikkhus or foremost bhikkhu in wisdom, if that was why that sutta was uttered, and because the Venerable Sariputta Thera heard it, it was perhaps uttered in the presence of the Venerable Ananda Thera, or as the Ananda Thera got the Buddha to promise him, any sutta, any discourse given in his absence would be redone to him at their next meeting. Then the sutta got into the books, as he was the treasurer of the Dhamma, so he carried the Dhamma, and it entered the Tripitaka. But perhaps if you ask the Buddha, that sutta should not be in the Tripitaka, because it was not uttered for any other reason, other than helping Sariputta to become chief among those in wisdom. You and I are never going to become that in this dispensation. That being the case, if you go through one of those suttas and take it to your teacher and say, teacher, please explain this to me. I have this problem with this particular sutta. And your teacher explains to you, well, actually, this is not something that you need to worry about. This is only something that Sariputta Thera needs to worry about. You must be able to drop your case. If not, you must either change your teacher, or you must change your ambition and forget about becoming an arahant and get yourself on the path to becoming chief among the bhikkhus with wisdom. Certainly not in this dispensation, so that's going to be in the next dispensation, at the very least. Otherwise, your pursuit is simply for the sake of Dhamma. So, that was a piece of advice that I shared with a group of our monks, because they're preparing to become higher, to receive their higher ordination, and go from a samanera to a bhikkhu, who is responsible for the upkeep of the shasana. And I shared with them what the shasana really is. That is what I taught them. What is meant by the shasana? What the shasana really is? What is the dispensation of the Buddha? The Buddha exists. The Dhamma exists. The Mahasangha exists. The shasana exists. To heal. That's it. To heal. We are here to heal. The Buddha came into this world to heal, not to preach, to heal. He had to preach to heal. That's why he preached. He didn't come here to preach. The Dhamma is here to heal. The Dhamma is not here. Remember, this is what I meant by the raft. This is one of the Buddha's similes. He says, use it as a raft. To get to the other side of the river, once you're there, let go of it. You have no other use of it. So the Dhamma is to heal. Once you are healed, then heal others. And if there is no healing to do, then let go of it. The Sangha is here to heal. And that is the only reason you must associate the Sangha. Don't associate the Sangha for anything else. Don't associate the Sangha to ignite fires that they're, because they're here to heal. It is a double-edged sword. Do remember that. I often tell our monks why our robes are red or a crimson color. To me, this signifies the color of blood. The blood that runs through our veins. I like that it is red. It's a crimson red. It reminds me that it is a double-edged sword. It reminds me of what can happen if abused, used incorrectly. Blood will be shed. It is a warning to oneself, to he who dons the robe, as well as to others around him. Blood is also the giver of life. Blood keeps beings alive. It is a symbol of vitality and life. But it is also a warning. Don't mess with it. And blood shall be shed. Maybe not in this birth, but most certainly in the next. That was another bit of advice given to our monks. It's not something to mess with. It is something to heal with. Use it for the right purpose and no harm can come. Only good can come. But use it for the wrong thing. That's a huge price to pay. A huge price to pay. So remember that in your association with the Sangha, in your association with the Buddha, in your association with the Dhamma, the noble triple gem is to heal. Don't use it for anything else. That is the only thing that exists to heal. Why would you use it for anything else? If you use the only thing to heal you for other things, then what are you going to use to heal yourself? See, aren't we also fortunate to have that which can heal us? Among us, in the four great hells, they do not have this. In many countries, they do not have this. In many cultures, they do not appreciate this. In the 10,000 world systems, this is the only place where you can find it. 10,000 world systems, not one or two, 10,000 world systems, this is the only place you can find it. In the trillion world systems, you will not find another Buddha. And in a trillion world systems, this is the only place where you can find it, the Noble Triple Gem. The only thing that can heal us. What must we use it for? How must we use it? Must we not use it? Just in case we handle it incorrectly? That is equally foolish. You seen those bottles that have the sticker fragile on them? What does that mean? Don't use it? Just because something's fragile, oh, it's fragile, so I'm not going to use it. Is that what the sticker is on there for? If you're not going to use it, why have a sticker on it? The sticker says, use me carefully. No, don't use me. If you're not using me, then you don't need the sticker. Use me carefully. So what is the color of fragile? Crimson red. That is the color of fragile. Handle with care. You must understand this is advice to you, and times by 100,000 is advice to myself. Because I've got that blade on me all the time. Double-edged. It's on me all the time. You come close to it when you come close to it, but it's on me all the time. So this is advice to me 100,000 times diluted is advice to you. Right. I'm going to now go back to where we stopped a couple of weeks ago. With our stick man. Let me see if I can get that up. There you go. So this was from the sermon, mind is willing but the flesh is weak, you will remember. Did you take some time to think this through? Did you take a moment, did you take some time to maybe listen to the sermon again? To go through it? Once or twice, because we are onto something here. We are on to understanding ourselves. What is it we call ourselves? Who am I? That's an important question to find an answer, isn't it? At least in 80 years' time, I've been with I, me, myself and I for 80 years, and people die not knowing who they've spent their entire lifetime with. But again, reason is they're far too busy trying to understand other people and other things. When they haven't still taken time to understand themselves. So, did you take some time to go through this? Let me walk you through this.
one more time. And let's see if we can take one more step forward. Okay? So, we were talking about this problem of I couldn't stop myself. This is when you feel the urge to do something. And you feel that you are trying to stop yourself, but there is another force somewhere that is pushing you to do it. And then we sometimes attribute that to the flesh or the body and say, we acquit our minds and say, it wasn't the mind, see, because I didn't want to do it, but it just happened. So I couldn't stop myself. And we ask the question, is it fair to say that? Is it reasonable? Are we victimizing the wrong person or the wrong thing? Let's go back to our piece of cake. It's surely gone off by now. It's been 2 weeks. But nevertheless, it's the same cake. So that's on a stool, and you know that cake is a vipaka. Right? Cake is a vipaka. How do we know cake is a vipaka? I think we already know this. Right? Isn't this how you say that it is due to my merits? I'm able to live like this. I was born into a rich family. Right? Or I was born beautiful. That I get to have all these things for myself. I get to eat and drink what I like, right? You know, I think people will generally attribute that to vipaka. I don't think there's a lot of concern or question there, particularly in Buddhist circles. People accept that what you receive as a result of the karmas you have done in the past. Okay? So how did this cake get here? That's a vipaka. Now, you can see this is a person, a stick man, and his eye. So if the cake is something that was received as a vipaka, then surely the eye is also a vipaka. Again, do we have any way to confirm this? Well, if someone is born blind, what do you say? It is the result of his bad karmas, right? So the karma has brought in this vipaka. In other words, now he's blind. So you might even say it may be because he blinded someone in a previous birth. You'll remember the story of Chakupala, the Arahatan Mahansa. As his actions intentionally led to a person going blind, in his final birth, he went blind the moment he became an arahant. So he had to live the rest of his life in pitch black darkness, although he was in full light. So he was in darkness, although he was enlightened. Now, so the eye is a vipaka. Cake is a vipaka. Eye is a vipaka. So between these two things, you have the event of the cake being seen by the eye. How does the image of the cake reach the eye? That we know is due to thanks to light rays.
So light rays, we know, well, this is just science, where we have light rays from the sun, bounce off the cake, right? And they hit the eye, and then we see the cake. Or at least the image of the cake reaches the retina of the eye. All of this is vipaka. I think there's no question there. We all are happy with that. Now, once this happens, that sensation goes through the brain, we know this because we have discussed this previously, and into the mind. Now, brain is also vipaka, right? So, if the eye is vipaka, then surely the brain is also vipaka. That's just another part of the body. And then the mind is also vipaka. How so? Because what is it that spawned this thought in the mind? We know chakkuncha paticca rupecha uppajyati chakku vinyana. In Pali, what that means is, when the eye comes into contact with sight, the eye consciousness is brought into being. Eye plus rupa gives rise to eye consciousness. Chakkuncha paticca rupecha uppajyati chakku vinyana. This is what happens. This is a very simplistic equation of that. This is vipaka. This is vipaka. Then surely what must this be? Is there any question about that? If this is vipaka and this is vipaka, then surely this is also vipaka. Now, you remember one of the important questions we asked ourselves was, this eye consciousness, could it have stopped its coming into being? Could what have stopped? Could it have stopped its coming into being? When the eye came into contact with the rupa, the eye consciousness was born. Now, that eye consciousness which is born, could that stop itself from coming into being? Could it stop its birth? As in not rebirth. I'm talking of its own birth. In that birth, could it have stopped it? Let's see if it could. Let's ask the eye consciousness to go and talk to Rupa. Hey, Rupa, don't you come along. Don't come to me. Don't go to the eye, because I'm going to be born then. How can the eye consciousness say that to the rupa? Because for the eye consciousness to be able to say that, it's already there. Meaning, rupa has already come in contact with the eye. Right? So, if this is step number one, this is step number two, this is step number three, and we are proposing a fourth step, which is the eye consciousness to go and talk to the rupa and say, rupa, hey, don't come into contact with the eye. Well, that is step number four. That comes after number three, which comes after one and two. So how could number four happen before number two? Now you get the drift. This is impossible. So that which is a result, or the result cannot stop causes that brought that result into existence from coming together. I think you understand that. Could the eye consciousness go to the eye? Failing with the rupa, it goes to the eye. Hey, eye, can you please not come into contact with this rupa? Because I don't want to be born. Who's talking? The eye that came to... Not eye, as in this eye. The eye consciousness that came into existence is now going and talking to the rupa and saying, can you not get into contact with rupa, please, because I was born. No, it's already happened. So you can't go back in time and not and stop one and two taking place, because to stop that from happening, you've got to be there. Therefore, it's an impossibility. Right? So when I and Rupa come into contact, I consciousness is born and you can't stop that. Now to explain this concept, we took the example of the stick man and we said, because the problem we are having is I can't stop myself. Right? So we said, raise your left arm. Remember? So when I say raise your left arm, what's really going on is the muscles of the arm are being contracted. Now, we could question this person's obedience, because we have asked them to raise their left arm, and what they're doing is they're contracting their muscles. Very different things. I say, raise your arm. This guy is busy contracting his muscles. Hey, what are you doing? I asked you to raise your arm. Why are you contracting your muscles? So what did we do? We went and asked the muscles. Muscles, please can you not do what you're doing? Because we don't want that. We just want the arm to be raised. And the muscles go, why are you asking me? Why are you talking to me? It wasn't my choice. It wasn't my doing. I was just minding my own business. I was just singing a song and just minding my own business. And then these nerve signals fired. And then I just couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop myself from contracting, the muscles would say. Would they not? So the muscles would say, you know, just like you, I'm also looking for the guy who got me to contract. If I find this guy, I'm going to tear him a new page. So, can you go and find out who's responsible for this? I don't want to contract, but these signals keep coming. Oh, there's another one. See, that's not me. I'm busy talking to you, and I keep contracting. You can tell that it's not me doing that. So I couldn't stop myself. And then we went to the. We found the nerve cells and we followed their axons all the way up to the nerve bodies, and we found the adjoining nerves, and we went along that path, and ultimately we got to the brain. So we are now at the brain. When we are asking the brain, your brain, why did you send that signal to the muscles to contract? That is unnecessary. We don't want that. And the brain says, you're talking to the wrong guy. Yeah. I have the same problem. I don't want to be doing this stuff. But I can't stop myself. But something keeps sending a signal from somewhere. And I have no choice here. Please can you sort it out for me? Please, I beg of you. So who's sending these signals to you? I think it's that mind dude over there. Go and talk to him. So we go to the mind dude. And we ask the mind, hey mind, why are you behaving like this? We don't want you to be sending signals to the brain and so on, right? Just mind your own business. Mind. And the mind goes, yes, I was minding my own business. Because that's what I'm like. I'm the mind, you know. So I mind my own business. But there was this thought. This thought object, this aramana that came to me, and there was nothing I could do. This thought object came, and the thought was born, and you know, I don't know, from that point on I just lost all control. I couldn't stop myself. So that's where we get to in the end. The mind is talking about a thought, and that is this consciousness. Right? We are talking about I consciousness. So, let me draw that path for you again, just very quickly. So, first remember we asked the arm, the left arm. Right? Then the arm said, don't ask me, go and ask the muscles.
We went and asked the muscles. The muscles said, don't ask me, go and ask the brain. Oh no, go and ask the nerves. Then we asked the nerves and the nerves said, don't ask me, go ask the brain. Then we asked the brain and the brain said, don't ask me, go and ask the mind. And then we asked the mind and the mind said, don't ask me, go and ask the thoughts. So no one seems to be taking responsibility. And yet the arm is being raised, and we don't want that. So imagine this, right? Forget the cake for a moment. So this guy has got a younger brother. Right? And so this arm is whacking him on his head. So now this young kid, this poor guy, he wants to try and stop this from happening. Right? So this is Ayya and this is Malli. So Malli is saying, Ayya, can you like stop hitting me? And Ayya is saying, don't talk to me, talk to the hand. Right? So Malli is saying, alright, hand stop. The hand says, don't talk to me, talk to the arm. Right? So he put the hand in front here. Right? So, with a smirky smile on his face, he said, don't talk to me, talk to the hand. Right? So Malli says, alright, hand, stop hitting me. And then hand says, don't talk to me, talk to the arm. And arm says, don't talk to me, talk to the muscles. And muscles say, don't talk to me, talk to the nerves. Nerves say, don't talk to me, talk to the brain. Brain says, don't talk to me, talk to the mind. Mind says, don't talk to me, talk to the thoughts. Right, then we go to the thoughts. Right, so this is what we have up here. Hey, thought, why are you hitting me? And thought says, don't talk to me. Talk to Ayya and Rupa. Right? Don't talk to me, talk to Ayya and Rupa. Because I came because the two of them got together. It was not my choice. I gave you the example of baby. That's a baby. Looks like a bug, but it's a baby. Is the result of mom and dad. So baby can't stop coming into this world, and baby can't come into this world and then go and stop mom and dad bringing the baby into this world. It doesn't work like that. Similarly, your eye consciousness, or any consciousness for that matter. So this is, if you were to generalize this, you have, let me get this bit out of the board. It's quite neat you can do that, isn't it? Right. So I'm going to generalize that. You're going to have thought is the result of faculty and object. Make sense? The faculty is your indriya. Object is the arammana, and thought is the chitta. What is the purpose of the thought? Arammana, vijanana. The characteristic of a thought is to perceive the object. So this thought was born to perceive this object. This thought was born to perceive this object. Yeah. So faculty was just minding its own business, and then object came and hit the faculty, and then a thought was born to perceive this object. That's the way it works. Now, you know by now that the thought has no power whatsoever to stop the faculty and the object coming together, because this is an, pardon the pun, it's an afterthought. It's not really an afterthought, but it's a thought that came after. So that as it came after, there's no way it could stop the before. This was before, this is after, right? Okay, so now where are we? This is Malli. Malli is saying,
Right. Ayya, stop hitting me, please. And then now we've come all the way to thought. Now, you're asking the thought, stop, saying, thought, can you stop hitting me, please? And thought says, don't talk to me. Go talk to the faculty and talk to the object. Right? What are the faculties? We have five plus one, six faculties. And we have objects, six objects. This is in its very, in its most simplest form. Right? If you take in the past, present and future, then of course this is six times in three, or rather infinity. There are infinite objects. Anything can take this place. But you have the six faculties and an infinite number of possibilities, although six categories, six types, but an infinite number of variants, right, and equals thoughts. Now who do we go and talk to? Right, let's try the faculty. Right, faculty, can you not come into contact with the object, please? Because then I get hit, Mali says. And then faculty says, I'm Vipaka. I'm not doing anything here. I'm just Vipaka. I'm not even karma. I'm Vipaka. So what can I do? There is no driver. I'm just driven. I'm Vipaka. Faculty says. So we know that the eye, as we said, the eye is a Vipaka, right? This is why you say, when you see a blind man, it must be the bad karma he's done, right? Pauno, you say? You say like that, don't you? Right? Exactly. Pau, no. Pau being singular and no is the way you ask a question. Right? What are you saying there? Oh, you say, sinno. I've heard people say that. Sinno. So, what they're saying is, sin, as in, they've done a sin. A sin was done in a previous birth, and as a result, no I. It's a pirate. Right? Such is a sin. So a sin was committed in the previous birth, and therefore no sin, no I. So if the deed was done in the past, that was a karma. Now we are talking about vipaka. The I is a vipaka. The I is not a karma. Karma is what? Karma is volition. Volition is the only thing that is karma. I is not karma. I is vipaka. You know this. So, I, which is one of the six faculties, is a vipaka. What about the ear? Why is someone's deaf? What do you say? Again, you say, sinno. Meaning? It was the result of a sin. A papa karma. Right? And if someone's lost their sense of taste or their sense of smell, again, you might say, sinno. Meaning, they just don't have the vipaka to be blessed, if you like, with a working sense faculty because of the karmas that have been committed previously, be that in this birth or in a previous birth, that we may not be able to say, but it is the result of a vipaka. But the most important point here being, it is a vipaka nonetheless. Whether it's this birth or previous birth or trillion births from now, back from now, ultimately, it is a vipaka. So if it is a vipaka, who's in control here? Who's in control of vipaka? Think. I want you to think. Who's in control of vipaka? If something is a vipaka, is anyone in control? Is anyone in the driving seat? Is anyone calling the shots? Is anyone saying, all right, start. Okay, pause. Oh, come on, sorry, rewind. Fast forward. Play, pause, stop, play. Anyone there to say that? No, it's just vipaka. Vipaka is vipaka is vipaka is vipaka. So then, if the eye is a vipaka, or any of the six faculties is a vipaka, now, who does this malli go and say, okay, stop, don't do that. What would the faculty say? The eye faculty. The eye faculty would say, sorry, it's not, can't, not, no can do. Nothing I can do. Whether that's the eye faculty, or the ear faculty, or the nose faculty, or the tongue faculty, or the mind faculty. It will still say, there's nothing I can do. Okay, then let's go to the object. My object, can you not come, please? What would the object say? It's not my doing. This is karma. Karma previously done gave me birth. And now, I'm here. So, I'm just a vipaka. There is no driver here. There's nothing sending me here. Or, I'm not coming here out of my own accord. So, there is nothing that I can do. And then, when these two guys get together, you have thought. So, let's go back to Malli. Malli is now at thought. And he goes to faculty and he fails because he can't find who's responsible for hitting me. Then he goes to the object and then he asks, are you hitting me? Can you stop hitting me, please? And the object says, it's not me, I just, I don't know. I only realized I was here when I got here. So I couldn't stop myself, says the object. And the thought says the same thing. So this poor guy, Malli, is lost. He doesn't know who to ask, but he keeps on getting hit. Now what do we do? Because Malli is looking for someone to hit back at. Right, Malli thinks, right, if you hit me, I'm going to hit you. So, but Malli is clever, he's an intelligent guy, unlike Aya. So, he wants to hit the right, you know, he wants to hit who's responsible. He realizes, you know, there's no point messing with, you know, these little ones, I need to go to the root. I'm going to sort out the guy who's responsible for all this. And that's why he went to hit the hand first. And then the hand said, whoa, 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 stop. Yeah, I'm not doing this, it's the arm. Go and talk to the arm. Then he went to the arm. He said, right, I'm going to hit you now. And the arm said, for what? And said, for hitting me. He said, I'm not hitting you. It's not me, I have no control. Remember the last time I patted your head? Again, that wasn't me. So, I'm neither hitting you, nor am I patting you. So, don't ask me. Fair enough. So, Malli went to mind. Or rather, muscles. And then to nerves and brain, you know the story. And all the way to faculty and object. And then when you go to faculty and object, now it's vipaka. They're both vipaka. So, who's Malli going to hit? Malli wants to retaliate. To whom? Now apply this into your own life. Right? Someone's hitting you. And what you know to do to stop being hit is to hit back. Who are you going to hit back? Hit back at. By you slowing down, I'm just going to give a punch in the face. Hang on. Why are you punching the face? Face is in no way connected even to this problem. If that's the case, then, you know, if I see two people fight, I'm going to come and hit you. And you weren't even at the scene. You know, if your argument is, I just hit random people when someone hits me, isn't that the same sort of concept? Arm is hitting me, and I'm punching the face. So, in which case, why don't you just punch yourself? Because if you're not treating the right problem, your problem is not going to be solved. So, who's responsible? I think it's Malli you should be saying sin, no? This guy's at a loss. What do you think? Ayya is hitting Malli. So this is a good lesson for Ayyas and Mallis who get into fights. Right? If someone starts this first, right? So either Malli will throw something at Ayya or Ayya comes and kicks Malli, and then that's the trigger. Now, my question is, what is the point of retaliation? It is some people's favorite pastime, right? Retaliation. Don't you hit me, I'll hit you back. I'm asking you, what is the point of retaliation? If you can't figure out who's responsible for this? What do you think? Who should Malli hit back at? If Malli goes and complains to Amma, Amma, Ayya hit me. I'm going to take Ayya's side. Why? Because he's lying. Ayya didn't hit him. Show me Ayya in this process. Amma, Ayya hit me. I'm saying you're lying because Ayya didn't hit you. Where's Ayya in the process? There's hand, there's arm, there's muscle, there's nerve, there's brain, there's mind, there's thoughts, there's object, there's faculty. Where's Ayya in the process? Okay, so you might say, hang on, well, it's Ayya's hand. Okay, so it's Ayya's hand, then it's Ayya's arm, then it's Ayya's muscles, it's Ayya's nerves, it's Ayya's brain, Ayya's mind, Ayya's thoughts, right? Ayya's object and Ayya's faculty. Even if you could say that was Ayya's faculty, how can you say it's Ayya's object? So who are you going to hit back at? What is the point of retaliation? Okay, take another example. Right, you're just going about your own business, and some guy bumps into you, and he starts shouting at you. Starts shouting at you. Okay? Now, okay, what are you going to do now? You don't like this. You don't like that he's shouting at you. What are you going to do? Let's ask him to stop shouting. What's he going to say? No, I can't stop myself. can't stop myself. Because I'm not shouting, it's the mouth. Okay, let's go to the mouth. Mouth, stop shouting. What's the mouth going to say? Well, it's not me, it's his muscles. It's this voice box, this tongue, right? So let's go to, generally keep it simple. Go to the muscles. Muscles, can you stop doing that, please? Muscles, say what again? Nerves. Nerves, stop that, please. Nerves, say what again? Brain. Brain says what again? Mind. Mind says what again? Thoughts. Thoughts says what again? Faculty and object. Even if the faculty, let's say, belong to this person, how on earth can you say the object belongs to the person? Because you see, if it belongs to you, you should be able to get it whenever you want. How do you know your car is your car? Like there's a line of cars parked outside and someone says, which one's yours? That one. Prove it. How do you prove it? Yeah, I can prove it. You go and get into the car and you drive away. See, it's my car. Right. So you can drive it whenever you want to, right? You can stop driving whenever you want to. Then you know it's your car. Okay. So you're saying the object is yours? Like get the object whenever you want. Whenever you want it. You think you can do that? Okay, question then. What is the name of the student who was in your second year classroom, who was three lines ahead of you and two to the left? What was his name? Oh, no, we shuffled Swami's answer. Okay. On the second day of school, in language class, at exactly 11:39 a.m. What was his name? Come on, get the object. It's yours, right? Get the object. Come on. What was his name? Okay, how many mouthfuls of rice did you eat yesterday? Exactly. You can't tell me it was about. I need exactly, because it's an object, right? It's an aramana. Because you went through that process. So, at that time, if you counted, you could have said that was 10 or 12 or whatever. But you went through it nevertheless. So tell me, how many mouthfuls? Come on. Is the object not yours? Okay, there's another object. Please don't take it at this time. Don't get this object now. Chimpanzee. Don't get it. I said don't get it. It's your object, right? So your car, you can decide when to drive, when not to drive, right? That's when you say it's my car. So, chimpanzee, don't get that object now. Okay, don't hear this voice. Come on, don't hear this voice. Why did you hear this voice? Don't hear this voice. Don't think about what I'm telling you right now. Come on, don't think about it. Okay, don't understand these words. Hey, don't understand these words. What are you doing? Why are you understanding these words? You know, this is such a misnomer that language can't even explain it. So they say understanding, you can't use that. You can't use that verb in that way. I am understanding you. Apparently, grammatically, that is incorrect. because it's such a misnomer. Because people don't get that, scientists don't get that this is a vipaka. Because people think, I'm doing it, but I can't not understand, I can't not understand. And I can't understand when I want to understand. So people are scratching their heads wondering what's going on. Until the Buddha comes and offers an explanation to this. Because this is vipaka. No one's in the driving seat. So, Malli, you want to hit whom? Who do you want to hit? The only thing you can hit, if you really wanted to, is hit vipaka. No, that is not Sopaka's brother. It's vipaka, it's just vipaka, right? How do you hit vipaka? Well, there's one way you could hit vipaka. What are you? What are you? So if Ayya is also all vipaka, then what are you? You're also vipaka, right? So if you want to hit vipaka, then just hit yourself. So Ayya is hitting on your head. You're like, yeah, that's right. I'm going to hit myself also. Stop hitting me. And then you hit yourself. No, you don't do that. Because again, where is vipaka? What do you hit? It's an energy. How do you hit energy? Energy is not something that takes up space. Karma is an energy. Vipaka is energy. And neither of these two things take up space. That is why you can continue acquiring karma. It's never going to fill up, right? There's not going to be a day, one day, you know, you just keep on doing karma, doing it, and at one point, you know, you try to do a karma and you can't. Because your karma bag is full. You don't get an error message saying, please take one out before you put the next thing in. So it's an energy, it doesn't take up space. It has no weight. It's an energy. And so is vipaka, it's an energy. So who are you going to hit? Now do you understand the question who is meaningless? That is why people say, I couldn't stop myself. Because who do you go to? Stop. When it's raining, who do you go to say stop? Because where's the who that makes it rain? When there's a tsunami, who do you go to say stop? Where's the who to make it stop? Because if there's a who to make it stop, there must be a who to make it start. That's as we've been speaking about this, right? Science says that is random. Others say that is God. So when you come to the extent of your ability to explain things, people find it very unsettling that you can't find answers to these questions. Because they want to know, who do I hit? So they go in from hand to arm, to muscle, to nerve, to brain, to mind, to thought, to faculty, to object. And then where do I go? Our science is just random thoughts. Thoughts are very random, you know, we can't explain how the mind works, so it's just very random. Right, it's random. And then you ask a God believer, how does that happen? That's God. God has a plan for everything. So really then, if you want to hit, Ayya is not the guy who you used to be hitting. Make an appointment with God. But the Buddha's explanation is very different. He says it is vipaka. Meaning there is no one responsible. There is no one who is responsible here. That is why he said, kammasakomi, kammadayado, kammayoni, kammabandhu, kammaparisarno, yankamman karissami, kalyanangva papakangva, tassadayado bhavissami. Its birth is in karma. This is a heritage, this is something you inherit from the karma. What is he talking about? He's talking about vipaka. Because that's where the question is, right? That's where we wended. Where, who do we go to now? So then he answers the question. Kamma sakomi. Birth is in karma. Kamma dayadu. This is the inheritance of karma. Or it's formed of karma. It's kamma sakomi. And then kamma yoni. Birth is in karma. Kamma bandhu. Kamma is your friend. Whose? Vipakas. Kamma patisarna. You take refuge in karma. Kamma is your kinsman. Who is he talking about? As in, who is he, the Buddha? So this is the capital H. Who is he talking about? He's talking about vipaka. And he's talking about vipaka's relation to karma. So vipaka is what? Kamma sakomhi. Vipaka is what? Kamma dayadu. Vipaka is what? Kamma yoni. Vipaka is what? Kamma bandhu. Vipaka is what? Kamma patisarno. And then, yang kammam karissami. If a karma is done, be it good or bad, tassa dayado bhavissami. That is what comes back as vipaka. If it's a good karma, you get a good vipaka. If it's a bad karma, you get a bad vipaka. Pabbajite nabinham pachave kitabba. A monk should reflect on this most regularly. Now, let's go back to Malli. Malli, who do you want to hit now? So Malli is jumping on his 2 feet. Right? Let me at him. Let me at him. Let me at him. Okay, let me at him who? We've just realized that vipaka is the cause of karma. So then Malli goes, right, who did the karma? Exactly the right person that Aya is hitting right now. So, you see, Malli wants to hit someone, right? Malli wants to hit the guy who's responsible for the hitting. Right? So, who's responsible for the hitting? Karma. Whose karma? Malli's karma. Malli wants to do what? Hit the guy who's responsible for the hitting. Well, that's exactly what Aya is doing right now. So, he doesn't need to do anything. He just needs to stay put. That's it, Aya, hit me. Just keep on hitting me, Aya. Thank you, Aya. Thank you. Thank you very much. Because I was looking for the guy who was responsible for the hitting, and I realized that it was me, so hit me. Now, what is the reason for retaliation? This is why Buddhists don't fight back. This is why Buddhists don't go tit for tat. A true Buddhist doesn't fight back. Because this karma was caused by volition, or is the same as volition. This is a chetana, or abhisankara, or volition, intention. Intention where? Of the mind itself. Intention of the mind or the thoughts in the mind, the thought, because there was a thought that once spawned in this mind, and it had an intention. That intention or volition resulted in a karma. That karma gave rise to vipaka. And that vipaka is now bringing the object and the faculty, and that is creating the thought. And that is taking rise now in the mind, in the brain, in the nerves, in the muscles, in the arm, in the hand, and the hand is hitting malli. And peace has been restored. The cycle is complete. So now do you see how what you give you get back? This mind is the mind here. This hand is the hand here. But this hand is hitting this body. And this body is sending those signals to the mind, which is now perceiving those hits, if you like. So, what did it give before? What did that mind give? That mind back, say, 2 million years ago, right? Hit. Thoughts arose in that mind to hit. And that volition created the karma. 2 million years later, that is now coming back as vipaka. Because there's no, you know, this is timeless. I'll explain to you what the true meaning of timeless is at some point in the future. They have very deep and profound meanings. So then vipaka, right, is the result of the karma. And then that vipaka is manifested as faculty and object, and hence thought, and hence mind, and brain, and nerves, and mind, and arm, sorry, muscles, and arm, and hand. Today you call it ayya, but really, if you look at who's responsible, it's the very mind that's looking to make a complaint. So in this world, you can only complain against one person. Who? Who's the only person you can file a complaint against? What's that? Who? Sounds very much like who? You. That's who. This is the cycle of karma and vipaka. So, okay, who do you want? What is the meaning of retaliation? What is the essence of retaliation? Why retaliate? Let's look at what happens if you do retaliate. Right? Say imagine now the malli now hits back at ayya. What's happening now? Right? What's happening now again? Mind is thoughts are being created in the mind with the volition of what? To hit. That is creating what? Karma. So what's going to happen 2 million years from now? Again. Is there anything so foolish as to hit back at someone who's hitting you? Is there anything so idiotic as shouting back at someone who shouts at you? That must be a practice reserved for idiots. Don't you think so? The wise don't do that. Naivereena Vedani. You can't treat violence with violence. You can't treat hatred with hatred. You see why now? So isn't Aya right by saying I couldn't stop myself? Who could have stopped this from happening? I mean, it can't be stopped now, but who could have stopped this from happening? Again, it's not a who could have stopped or what could have stopped. See, if this mind, 2 million years ago, had not spawned those thoughts with that volition, then that karma wouldn't have happened, wouldn't have occurred. And then that this vipaka would not have been generated. And then the object would not have slotted in. And then that thought arising in Aya's mind. Now, I say Aya's mind, but you know, essentially you see that this is simply a process. There is no Aya's or Mallis here. It's just a process. For our non-native speakers, Aya is simply the singular term for elder brother, and Malli is the term for younger brother. Amma is, I think you'll know, mother. Right, so again, you come back here, you're talking about, you know, someone shouting at you. Right? Who's responsible? So, you know, why do you shout back? And say, stop shouting at me. Or you shout back in equally bad language, if not worse. See, now this is retaliation, right? When you retaliate, what really happens? You must be able to see the joke here, folks. When you retaliate, what really happens? Are you not creating the very stuff you're trying to fight back against? That's what I'm saying. Retaliation is for retards. Those who don't understand this, those who are not wise, those who are fools, those who are ignorant. I want these words to ring in your mind henceforth. Understand this and you will never retaliate. Not because it's a bad thing to do, because it's the most pointless thing to do. It's like a man who's thirsty, lost in the ocean, drinking seawater because he's thirsty. Is that not reserved for the retards? What is the reason he's getting thirstier and thirstier and thirstier? Because he's drinking the very water that makes him thirsty. And what is his answer for that? Drinking more salty water. What is that doing? Making him thirstier. And then what does he do? Drinks more salty water. Then what does that make it, what does that happen? What does that do rather? Makes him even more thirsty. So is he not doing the very thing that is creating the problem? See, guys, understand, here's the Buddha's gift to us. Look at how much freedom he unlocks for us. People don't know this stuff. Sin, no. 8 billion people live on this planet and they don't know this stuff. So what do? When they hit back. Tell me it's not worthwhile me doing these sermons in the hope that 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years from now someone will get to listen to this sermon and realize this and they'll stop retaliating. Tell me it's not worthwhile. Tell me it's not worthwhile getting this recorded, editing this, posting it online, sharing it with others, transcribing this, transliterating this, time logging this, writing it down, sharing those notes with people, asking others to come along and listen to this sermon, inviting the devas and the brahmas to come and listen to this, tell me it's not worthwhile. Have we not just proved that retaliation is for retards? Fighting back is bonkers. But 8 billion people live on this planet and they don't know this. Maybe a couple of hundred people listen to this sermon and they'll get it. Is that not a drop in this vast ocean? You know how people say, when a new song comes along and it's a real hit among people, right? And people say, ears that have not listened to this song are not worth it. Yeah, it's a song that they should be saying that about, isn't it? It's a song they should be saying that about, right? Ears that have not heard this song are not worth it. This is the gift of the Buddhas. Can you see it in all its glory? Can you see how powerful this is? Can you see how much insight there is in this? Can you see how much essence there is in this? So I was right to say I couldn't stop myself. Truth of the matter is, there was really no idea doing it. It was just a process. What kick-started the process? Conventionally, I could ask, who kick-started the process? The very person who's trying to find who's responsible for it. What goes round? Yeah? What goes round? Of course. Now you see how. What you give is what you get. That's quite something to think about, is it not? You know, if you've understood this, please teach this to your children. Share this in your own words with your friends. Heal those festering wounds, those burning hearts. See, they don't know they're the creator of their own suffering. You are responsible for your own suffering. Of course. In every sense of the word, responsible. Retaliation is for retards. Anyone with half a brain cell, if they understand this, if they have listened to this, right? If you don't listen to this, of course you don't know it. So, you know, you can't be sent to the glutton for ignorance. But if you listen to this, anyone with half a brain cell should understand retaliation is madness.
So I want you to think about this. So I wanted to go a step further, but I think we've come to a really good point in the sermon to leave you something to really think about. Right? You understand the concept now. Whenever you're hit, now we took the example of Malli being hit by Ayya, and now he wants to hit back. Right? He wants to know who's responsible for this so I can go and sort it out. This is Ayya, stop. Ayya says what? I can't stop myself. I can't stop myself. Look, this is, it's not me, it's the hand. Talk to the hand. Hand says, not me, talk to the arm. Arm says, not me, talk to the muscles. Muscle says, not me, talk to the nerves. And so on and so on and so on and so on. And then you finally get to the thoughts. Thought says, not me, talk to the faculty, talk to the object. Like, even if at this point you still feel and you still believe, but Swami knows that's Ayya's hand, Ayya's arm, Ayya's muscles, Ayya's nerves, Ayya's brain, Ayya's mind, Ayya's faculty, you can't say that of Ayya's object. You can't say it's Ayya's object. I prove, you know, we proved that, didn't we? If it's Ayya's object, he should be in complete control of it. Aren't there times when Ayya says, why am I thinking about this stuff? I just want to get it out of my head. But it won't. Is that because it's Ayya's stuff, Ayya's object? Why does Ayya spend time thinking, you know, actually I'm trying to think about something, it's just not coming to my mind. What is it? Why would Ayya spend time doing that? If it's Ayya's object, he should be able to use it, pull it, make use of it, destroy it, eat it, whenever he wants. He's not in control of the object. So even if you put faculty in Ayya's camp, object cannot be put in Ayya's camp. You know, for now, okay, for now, right? Let's take all the above things are Ayya's, but the object cannot be attributed to Ayya. Like you can't say Ayya is the owner of the object. That's just an object. It's the sight, the sound, the smell, the taste, the touch, the thought that came into the mind, the mental object. And those things are entirely vipaka. Vipaka is the result of karma. Karma is created by intention of the mind. And who's responsible for that? The very mind that's seeking. That's asking the question, who's responsible for this? That's why I said, the only person you can complain in this world is yourself. The only person you can have a grudge in this world is yourself. Because no one else, absolutely no one else is responsible for your suffering. You have created your own suffering. Anyone who thinks otherwise is ignorant. Think that through. Contemplate on that. And, you know, use this information and go back into your yearly goals, the things you sent through, and said, you know, you want to stop doing this, you want to stop doing that in this new year. You want to stop having those arguments with your siblings. You want to stop feeling angry when someone shouts at you, right? Now see why those things are coming your way. Who do you need to be angry with? I don't know if young children can understand this sermon in these words, but you know, parents, you can explain this to your children in your own words, in words that they can understand. Yeah, all fights can stop if you understand this. Because the moment you hit back at someone, you've just dug your own grave. You know, explain that to your children. Buddha, I hit you. The worst thing you ought to do is hit back. Because if you hit back, you're going to get hit back twice. And this is how it happens. Run away.
and hide if you must, but never hit back. Not because it's bad. Not because it's bad to hit Ayya. Seriously, that's not why. The reason is, the moment you hit, you're going to get hit. If you hit Ayya, Ayya is not going to get hit because you hit him. So if Malli hits Ayya, Ayya is not going to get hit because Malli hit him. He's going to get hit only if he hits Malli. Only what you do is going to come back to you, not what others do. So if you feel like others are doing stuff to you, that's because you've done them to others. That is the only reason. So who's responsible? So please understand, retaliation is for retards. Retaliation is reserved for retards. So if you retaliate, what does that make you? When someone shouts at you, you shout back. What does that make you? When someone hits you, you hit back. What does that make you? When someone takes what belongs to you, and you want to retaliate, you take what belongs to them. What does that make you? I have proved to you, if you retaliate, you are a retard. Harsh, huh? You don't like that? Okay, prove to me you're not a retard then. It goes for all of us. If I retaliate, I'm a retard. Someone asks you, who's a retard? Someone who retaliates. That's enough. I'm just thinking about, this is what I'm saying, folks. Right, countries fight with each other, right, don't they? Like, entire nations, right, they hit us, so we're going to hit back. What does that make the entire nation? What does that say about the people in power? I'm not going to put the label, you do that. You're the one who put them in power, not me. But then ultimately a country is led by people like them. I'm not having a go at anyone. I'm having a go at retaliation. So I'm not having a go at anyone. I'm having a go at retaliation. Retaliation is done because of ignorance. That's why I absolutely hate ignorance. I find it disgusting, I find it distasteful, I despise it. Ignorance is the curse upon all of us. Now when you understand this, you are not ignorant of this. If you see this, now you have achieved kammasagata sammaditti. If you acknowledge this, if you embrace this, if you understand it, if you comprehend this stuff that we just talked about, kammasagata sammaditti. Your understanding of karma and vipaka is there. So how can you retaliate? You know, if you understand this stuff, if people understood this stuff, right, we wouldn't need jails. We wouldn't need prisons. One, people are not going to retaliate, and two, people are not going to hit in the first place. Because they know, if I hit, I'm going to get hit back. And that is how there's going to be peace. So if you want world peace, what must you do? Tell me. Right? Have a symposium. Right? Bring the leaders of all the countries together. And then talk about lots of stuff, right? Or how about we take our time and do what it is that you are doing right now? One, listen to the Dhamma and absorb it. Two, share it with others. Share it with everyone else in this world. As far as you possibly can. During your lifetime, folks, share this with as many people as you can, because people will find peace then. Do it with compassion. Do it out of the goodwill that emanates from the bottom of your hearts. People live in terror. People live in fear. People's lives are completely destroyed because people don't understand this stuff. They don't understand the Buddha's teaching. They have not seen the Buddha. They do not associate the Noble Triple Gem. They do not get a chance to talk to the Mahasangha and listen to what they have to say. They do not have a teacher. So all they have is the Asat Purushas, who say, hey, you got hit, hit back twice as hard. So he learns a good lesson. God. Can you imagine what an idiot someone like that is? Like, did he hit you? Did he hit you? Did he hit you? Right, let's both go hit him. You know how some school kids are, right? When they get into gangs. You know, isn't this the stuff we need to be teaching in schools? Huh? Tell me. Isn't this the stuff that students, young students, teenagers of this day and age should learn? Isn't this the answer to school gangs? Right, what do kids in a, children, when they get into a gang, they do? What do they do? Right? If anyone in the gang gets hit, then what does everyone else do? Right, they gang up, and then? They completely go and destroy. Everyone in that gang gets involved in starting a new transaction. You see, the transaction is with yourself. I've seen children getting into brawls like that. For my good fortune, I had good teachers, I had good parents who always taught me to stay away from those sort of gangs. I was so lucky. Those are my merits. But what about children of today? You know, for parents, this is why I say you must teach these things to your children. Show them that they make up their own suffering. You're only going to get hit if you hit. So why hit when someone else got hit by a third party? Why are you getting involved in that mess? But normally what happens, you've seen these, you know, children in schools get into fights and gang up on other schools, and God. By God, I meant karma. I really feel for them. This is the stuff we need to take to them. Yes, teach them science, teach them maths, teach them social studies, teach them social responsibility. Teach them history, teach them art, teach them geography. Why not teach them the teachings of the greatest teacher? Why not teach them the path to their happiness, to their freedom? Because that is what they seek. They want to find out they want to find answers to the fire that burns within them. And we teach them science, and we teach them math. They want to know why they can't stop themselves from hitting back someone when they get hit. They don't know how to quench the fire of hatred that burns within them. They want to hit back. They want to retaliate. They want to break the nose of the guy that stole their girlfriend. They want to knock someone dead just because they went away, or held a hand flaunted with a girlfriend, or flirted with a girlfriend. Isn't this what we need to teach them? Isn't this what we need to be teaching in prisons? So that people don't do stuff that gets them back in there again? You know, when you understand this stuff, excuse me for using a very extreme example. Even if your mother got raped in front of your eyes, you wouldn't retaliate. I use it intentionally because I want to bring an extreme example. Why? Because anything this side of that should speak for itself. Even if your mother got raped in front of your own eyes, how could you retaliate? Because isn't she getting what she deserves? She's getting what she deserves. If you go and get involved in that situation, you're going to get what you deserve. The guy who just raped her is going to get what he deserves. You don't need to get involved in that. Best you can do is if you can teach them both how to find peace, then do that. But this is the truth. The truth is the truth is the truth. You can't bend it. You can't prove this to be false. In this world of Maras and Bhimans and humans and Devas and Brahmas, this cannot be proven false because this is the teaching of the great Buddha. He who knew it all, he who saw it all, he who realized it all, the self-awakened one. Think about this. Contemplate on this. Absorb this into your life and make it your ambition to share this with at least one more person. Especially young children, school children, teenagers. If you are a teacher, share this in one of your lessons. If you can, I don't know, you probably need permission for that from someone who thinks this is not what they need to be teaching, but it's math and Euclidean geometry. Perhaps you need to get their permission for that. I don't know. You do the creative stuff. But share this with someone. There are 8 billion people in this world who don't know anything about this. And what do? They fight back. Because they think that is what they need to be. That they think that is their personality. Because they think if they don't fight back, they're undermining themselves. They're belittling themselves. Remember, retaliation is for retards. I'll leave you on that note. Let's take a moment to trans merits and bring the sermon to a close. Let's take a moment then to trans the merits we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting Pirith and listening to the Dhamma, and engaging in various meritorious deeds. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha, and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha, present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path, and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that among them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to Guru Swami Mohansa and all other monks resident at this monastery, as well as the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this merits and express our gratitude to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting them to join us. May to the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in woeful planes, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May to the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery, to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter and arms, robes and medicines, as well as those of you who have passed on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May to the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our mothers and fathers and husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, employers and employees, and to all those who have helped and supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds and fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfilling the Sambhushasana. Let us also transfer merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And may through the power of these merits, they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all who have been our families and friends and acquaintances in this infinitely long journey in samsara and who have helped and supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form they could. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to them. Let us also transfer merits to the members of the armed forces and as well as the police force who have sacrificed their lives and continue to do so to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. May all who have lost their lives in the war, be their friend or foe, rejoice in these merits we have acquired today. Let us also transfer merits to all those who have lost their lives in natural calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides and pandemics, including the most recent and prevailing one, reminding ourselves that among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey in samsara. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to them. And may to the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in woeful planes, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds and fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Finally, as always, all may to the power of the blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahatan Mahanses and Arahat Menin Mahanses in this land itself. And finally, may to the power of all the mates we have acquired today, you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become an Arahatan Mahanse and Arahat Menin Mahanse in this very life and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. We will now conclude the sermon. May the Noble Triple Gentle